Welcome to the Recover You podcast. I'm Kyleen.
And I'm Patrick.
We are a couple in recovery
from sex addiction
and betrayal trauma. Together, we share our story to encourage you on your journey. It's here that we talk about sex addiction, betrayal trauma, mental, emotional, and physical health, faith, and anything and everything needed to recover you to your most authentic self that God created you to be. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Recover You. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Kyleen. How are you? You look nice today. You look pretty.
Thank you.
You do.
I had a fun morning. What did I do this morning?
You conducted the Tabernacle Choir.
Yes. It was my church choir directing debut.
Hours of practice. Mm.
And it was fun. The last time I did any sort of music direction was... It was like 2017 into 2018 or 2018 mm-hmm. to 19, something like that.
Yeah.
Because it was before cancer. I know that. But it was at a high school, and I did two high school musicals, and one was Legally Blonde. That was so fun.
Yeah.
And what was the other one? Young Frankenstein. Yep. And then I did Willy Wonka mm-hmm. with the, I think it was the middle school, the second year I was there. It was really fun. So anyway, it's been a really long time since I
conducted.
Did any sort of conducting or directing. And
yeah.
I got to do that with the church choir this morning, so that was really fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
You did a good job singing.
Thank you. I was paying attention. I was looking. So your cues were spot on.
I was pointing everybody. You come in. Everybody comes in.
You get a car.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So today we're going to do a Q&A. Some people in my Recover You Facebook group for betrayed partners have dropped some questions for someone in recovery to answer. So from the perspective of a recovered addict, i.e. you.
Hey, look at that.
They dropped some questions sort of with that in mind. So we're just going to jump right in.
Okay.
Okay, so let's just start with this one. Is there any point where you think your spouse, that would be me, could not worry about a slip up or a relapse anymore?
Oh, wow. So, I think what's interesting there is I think there's two parts to that question in my mind, the way I hear that. The first one is, will a recovering addict slip up, right? And so I guess it's possible, but it doesn't have to. You know, you and I were talking about this before, and it's like, I think this realization came to me this week is like, I just moved through life and I walk through life and I don't do anything inappropriate. I just don't. And so it's a really interesting thing. So I make good decisions on, you know, whatever, you know, if there's a, like, I don't turn on the TV when I travel. If I'm, you know, driving down the highway and just you catch a billboard or something that you might go, oh, that might be a little sketchy. You just look away. You know what I mean? So you just make good decisions all the time. It becomes part of the fabric of who you were versus before when, you know, you were, you know, maybe making not good decisions on mm-hmm. that. You know what I mean? Like your limbic brain would take over. I also think too that, you know, you got to define what a slip up is. Each couple has to define what that is. You know what I mean? Looking at pornography is not really a slip. It's actually a relapse. I don't know what a slip would be, but I think, is it possible that somebody in full recovery can have a slip? I would say no, because that person, when you're in full recovery, you have no desire to engage in any sort of slip up behavior. You're fully aware. You're like, whoa, what's going on? My emotions are off. Why do I feel like this weird pull from, you know, 5 years ago or whatever? And then you take action. You say, okay, something's up. Let me go clean it up. Let me make sure things are okay. And, you know, and let me get in touch with my emotions, that sort of thing. If you're not in recovery, well, then maybe you haven't fully established those patterns. I think the next part of that question, what is it? You know, when does the spouse stop worrying about it?
Is there any point where you think your spouse could not worry about a slip up or a relapse anymore?
That's on the spouse. I mean, that really is on the spouse, because you can have a situation where somebody's completely recovered and doing great and doing all the work, but you just don't trust them yet. And so you have to kind of determine, okay, what is it that's creating that there? And it could just be the depth of the betrayal. it could be the degree of the healing that the betrayed spouse has gone through that's just creating these triggers. I think much like I was saying on the attic, when there's a trigger, I think that also leads, hey, is there something that we need to clean up here? Is there something that's going on? Like, where is this feeling coming from? And stuff like that. So like, never putting a, it's like, well, why don't you just trust me? Well, this major thing happened. And so it's two different paths. It's the addict going to recover, doing the deep work there. Then it's the trust component. Those are separate, but together.
Yeah. So like when you're answering the first version, you were talking about the difference between sobriety versus recovery. So someone in true recovery is very, very unlikely to relapse, period. Yeah. So for a spouse, it's going to be understanding the difference between those two and seeing the signs of someone being in recovery. And then for the second part of, you know, is there any point where your spouse could not worry? That has a lot to do with one, is their spouse in recovery? And two, is the betrayed partner, have they done all of the work and continue to do the work? Because I think it is a long process,
right,
as different things come up, to heal the wounds that are most likely to get triggered over time. Right. So,
Yeah. And, you know, once again, we all carry our family of origin. We all carry our traumas into this situation. So a particular spouse may, and I've seen this in groups, a particular spouse may go, great, awesome, I think you're doing great, and not ask questions, don't worry about it, and all that stuff. Another spouse may be constantly triggered. Another spouse may be constantly, you know, going through that process.
Mm-hmm. Okay, second question. What is it like for you when your spouse questions you, especially in the beginning of recovery?
I think the beginning of the process, I was very much like, yep, got to answer these questions, got to answer them. And even today, if you have questions, and there was one last night, as a matter of fact.
That wasn't necessarily a question, was it? It was just...
Oh, it was a question.
Wait a second. Oh yeah, it was. Yeah. Oh yeah, I remember.
Yeah. It was absolutely quite.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I was thinking I was a little triggered by something. I was like, did I? Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the comfort I have when I get questioned is I know I'm not doing anything. So, like, what did I do last night? Remember what I did with your hand?
Mm-hmm.
What did I do?
Yeah, you put it on your chest and you're like, see, my heart rate is fine.
Yeah, my heart rate wasn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't been the case. Like, you know, before when things were coming out, my heart was beating like crazy, you know?
Yeah, in the beginning.
Yeah. So I feel like questions, you know, and sometimes questions come when you're, you know, when you're tired or when you're whatever. And that's just, that is what it is. But I mean, I really, when I can rationalize it, which I always do, I'm like, you know, this is part of it. It just is, you know, and I think there's a degree of it because you're never abusive with it. You're never any of those things. Like if, you know, if you come home from work and your wife greets you at the door and throws a plate at your head and says, you know, what is this? And it's like nothing you've done. Well, you know, maybe you got to kind of work through that stuff as a couple, you know what I mean? To kind of, you know, provide a level of safety so you can have these questions. But, you know, there's always a, you know, it's not pleasant to be asked questions, especially the longer it goes and, you know, you're not doing anything. I mean, it was never pleasant to be asked questions. Let me just state that. But it is just part of it. You know, it's just part of it. You've had a lot of questions this week, you know, about different things. And I think it's just the cycle, you know, that we're in. I mean, it doesn't derail us. It doesn't take us off track. It doesn't change my healing. You know, I can still stay in recovery and withstand your questions, and you know, so it's fine. It's really okay.
Well, and I think also it's important for the addict to also understand that being present for those and answering the questions is part of the recovery, reconciliation, and trust building process.
Yeah.
And so if a betrayed partner comes up against someone who has hurt them that isn't willing to have conversations when thoughts come up or questions come up, you know, then that's very, it's going to slow down the process, if not leave some really, really open wounds.
Well, you know, I think, you know, put that question back on you. I mean, how have you, because I'm, you know, I'm sure there's times I've done it very well and then times I haven't done it as well. Like, what has helped you? What has made things harder when questions are being asked?
So I think always knowing that, so I try and especially once you got into actual recovery and things settled down and we were past disclosure. And so like the things started to calm down a little bit. I really try I'm not necessarily accusing you when I ask questions. I'm just asking a question. I'm trying to gather information about something. So like last night, we'll just go into that because that's a good example of like how this to answer your question. So something popped up on Amazon of like continue shopping or sales today or whatever. And I saw that and I was like, that's not something I would have searched, but it can fall into the category of sometimes what the cat is like making so much noise. So it can fall into the category of like sometimes when men are not truly in recovery, they might like qualify a behavior by saying, well, I Googled something that is somewhat inappropriate, but still not, you know, quote unquote porn or whatever on Amazon to look at, right?
Yeah.
And so anyway, something had popped up. And so I was like, wait, like, have you like, why is this on there? And to be clear, he did not search anything. It was like some sort of like, you know, today's sales or, you know, whatever it was. But the image itself kind of triggered me. And then he had been gone all week in a training that I wanted him to be at that we will talk about another time. But he was surrounded by a lot of women all week. And so it was out of our regular pattern. It brought some things up as I knew it might. And so we just had some more conversations around that. So to answer your question, I think I try not to accuse. I try to gather information. Your response, whenever it's calm and rational and willing to engage in the conversation, very helpful. If it comes across defensive or wanting to shut it down, or even I think understandably before you did a lot of healing work, when it would maybe trigger a lot of shame, that maybe is a little more difficult for both of us, as opposed to when the healing work is done on both sides. It's kind of just it's a much calmer conversation generally, not always, but it can be, right? Yeah, where it's like, I'm asking a question, you answer, everything's fine, we move on. Sometimes there might be emotions involved. Sometimes there might be crying or, you know, different triggers or whatever. Yeah. But I think to answer your question, when you're willing to show up and just sit there and not make me feel bad for asking the question, I think that's probably the most helpful.
Yeah. You know, and what's interesting, I think this is important to tell everybody, is that you don't always react the way you want because you're tired. You're, you know, you could be hungry. You could, so it's okay. I think the thing is just remember to kind of center back to, you know, what's going on. Like I try to always pull back to the big picture of, you know, like, hey, this did happen.
There's a reason
why these questions are coming up. Let's just get through this, because I was very comfortable in the moment last night that I hadn't done anything. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was like, okay, well, if, you know, this is not really going to go anywhere because there's nothing for me to worry about, you know.
Is the polygraph worth doing with a potential 30% false reading? What are the pros and cons from the addict's perspective about doing a formal disclosure with polygraph? I'll just tap into this really quickly. From my perspective, I think the accuracy goes up tremendously when it is applied in a safe way. Mm-hmm. And the counselor, the addict, the betrayed partner, and the polygrapher are all sort of on the same page of, we want this process to be successful. Like, we're on the team of the addict passing the polygraph.
Right.
So we're actually going to do, hopefully we're going to do an episode with Patrick's polygrapher. And so we're going to answer a lot of those questions in more detail about accuracy and like what things to look for and like how to make it the most successful thing possible. But I just kind of want to start with that. So from your perspective, is the polygraph worth doing?
I would say yes, because, you know, you go through one of the hallmarks of any addiction is denial, right? And so as you move through your double binds, as you move through a position where you no longer are living in denial, that's where real freedom starts to come in. So the polygraph is a really effective tool to that end. And I remember, as scared as I was for that first polygraph, because, you know, we were dredging up things for the full therapeutic disclosure that I had forgotten about. And so like, I was trying to be truthful. I was trying to make amends. I was trying to do, you know, what was going through my mind through this whole thing was I owed it to you. I wanted to be a good example for Keegan as best I could in that situation. And sometimes when you do things like this, you do hard things to reconcile for them. Right. And so that was the polygraph. I think what hit me after I passed the first one was it was like a realization that, hey, I can tell the truth. Cause I had gone through, you know, when your secrets are being discovered, I mean, you're just like, man, what is wrong with me? You know? And so you go into the polygraph and you pass it and you go, wow, I actually did this. And it wasn't easy. It was hard. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was, I remember, I think the question that cause he even mentioned, he's like, oh, you're a little fuzzy on that question was the one, like, you know, to the best of your ability, had you, you know, mm-hmm. And so that's, it's such a broad, like, thing, you know.
Did you finish the question?
Yeah, yeah.
To the best of your ability, did I
disclose everything to you, you know, to the best of my ability? Mm-hmm. And so I had, you know, I had really tried, mm-hmm. and so it came out that way. But I guess he did say, he's like, boy, your emotions, your stuff was hopping. You didn't fail it, but you were hopping all over the place. And so, I think, you know, I think the polygraph is important because it also helps the spouse, I think, two things. The betrayed spouse, the husband's willing to go do something hard. You know, the addict, you know, is willing to go do something hard because it's not pleasant. There is no way about it. We shouldn't sugarcoat it and say it's an enjoyable experience because it's not. It really isn't. And I think each time you come up, whether you decide to do an annual, whether you decide to do a 5-year, whether I think that discussion has to be had. You have to have that discussion as a couple to understand the utility. And let me make sure I kind of explain it here. So if a polygraph is not doing anything except pulling up negative feelings, and then you also, the spouse still doesn't believe him or anything like that, well, then you shouldn't do a polygraph because it's just a further thing.
Yeah, my perspective on a polygraph is always, no matter from the first one to the last one, it should be because it's a trust building thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when it fails, when it stops being that, if it's just something that raises more doubt or whatever, then you should stop, you know, you should just stop doing them. So I think it was very, very heartening for me. I don't know how it felt for you, but it was very heartening for me to be able to get through that and then go into disclosure because I did it right before therapeutic disclosure.
I think though I like the way we did it. Everyone does it a little bit mm-hmm. differently. Yeah. I particularly like they were on separate days.
Yep.
That the polygraph was first. Mm-hmm. So I felt very confident going into the disclosure
right.
Because you had passed the polygraph and it had that question of like, is the disclosure complete and accurate?
Yeah, right.
And so then I was like, okay, well, the hard part's done. Now I just have to sit through the disclosure, but I know that that's it. There's not going to be more. It's true. So I think the way we were really lucky, not only with the polygrapher that we got, being a very like calm, even keel, compassionate, wanting you to succeed polygrapher, but also the order that we did it. For whatever reason, we ended up doing that. I'm not sure exactly why or how we ended up doing that. But I like
might have been recommended that.
Yeah,
that's, you know, that's where. And it was interesting because they do different things. You know, in our particular case, you wrote the questions because I remember when I reached out to him, he was like, "Okay, send me your disclosure, and I'll pull questions off of that." And so it was like, no, we're not doing that. So you got to be really careful with it. You got to make sure the questions are the
questions.
I would say
be proactive about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually personally recommend that you do the questions, that you don't have them randomly pull from the disclosure. I think there's ways that, again, kind of going into the efficacy, the success of it, mm-hmm. You don't want to blindside the partner. We've talked about that a lot. Like
the questions need to be kind of limited in nature. You know, I think if you're like, you know, are you honest with your feelings? You know, like
they need to be very clear yes and no.
Right,
they need to be limited in number.
Absolutely.
And very easy to, and the addict needs to have access to them
right.
ahead of time.
Right.
Okay. So that being said about the polygraph, what are the pros and cons from the addict's perspective about doing a formal disclosure with polygraph? So maybe just what are the pros and cons of both, and then maybe together or however you want to answer.
Well, I talked about the polygraph. I think on the disclosure, once again, it's a lot of times addicts of any addiction, don't understand the full depth of how, you know, once again, denial is really big. So when you take the time to write a disclosure and to put down on paper what you've done, sometimes it's very shocking. Sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, you know, because we live lives, our lives in moments. And so moments add up to a lifetime. And so if you have been a lifetime addict, all of these moments start to come up and you're like, oh my gosh, you know what I mean? I think that's what kind of hit me. I was like, oh wow. You know what I mean? Like I was unaware because you compartmentalize, you know, you move from, hey, it's my 20s. Hey, it's my 30s. Hey, it's my 40s, you know? And so that was a big realization of how much, and it motivated me to do the work. It really did motivate me to do the work. I think going through the disclosure as a couple, and once again, you shouldn't do the disclosure if you don't plan to reconcile, because once again, it's stupid. It's just an exercise in torture, you know. But if you plan to reconcile, you want to do this because you owe it to your spouse. I remember thinking, you know, like, and you had kind of said this too, is like, you know, I need to be fully informed to move forward. And so, like, it was my chance to do that for you. And then you could make your own choice at that point. So I think once again, you start to live in integrity. Integrity doesn't mean nobody knows anything bad about you. Integrity means that you're sharing what you've done and you're stepping into it and you're saying, this is me and I'm working on it. And yeah, you're not sugarcoating things. You're mm-hmm. not, you know, that's, to me, that's integrity.
Are there any cons of doing a disclosure for a couple that is staying together? Or cons of not doing a disclosure, sorry.
Oh, are there cons to not do a disclosure if a couple decides to stay together? Mm-hmm. I believe so. I think once again, you know, the and you always held the vision on this. You come out of something like this, you want to be a better couple. You don't want to be the couple that you were. You want to actually find a way to be a better couple. So why would you just ignore, you know, what's there? Because those questions are going to come up. You know, I've talked to spouses and stuff like that later, and they're like, well, I wish I had, you know, sent them off to healing, or I wish I had asked more questions. And I wish, you know, you don't have that. If you go through a full therapeutic disclosure, it's over. You know what I mean? You have all the detail and then you go, okay, is this information that I can manage back into our relationship, mm-hmm. or is it not? And mm-hmm. either way is fine, but it allows you to move forward under yeah. the guise of you know,
and sometimes
possessing all the details.
Right. I think, and that's an important phrase, the guise of possessing all the details, because I think there are certain circumstances where people will have a little bit of information, and when they're afraid to ask questions or for whatever reason choose not to ask questions or don't go through disclosure, it absolutely can come up later in a way that's like, I didn't have all the information. And it's just, in my mind, it's almost asking for the pain to be prolonged in some sense, because then you're dealing with it in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years if it's not really pulled up at the root mm-hmm. and completely processed for both of you, as painful as that is. But to have everything on the table completely, both of you engaging in the healing process with sincerity, that's really, I think, when you're looking at this really bad thing happened, what do we want to come out of it?
Yeah.
We want to be healthier,
right?
Like you
right.
said.
Yep.
So any cons to the disclosure and the polygraph together, or maybe not doing the polygraph, or pros and cons of, you know, just the whole kit and caboodle of doing
it? I don't think there's any cons to doing it. Now I will say that it can be done poorly. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, the way we did it is we both had a therapist. We came together. I've heard of situations where one therapist, you know, represents both the spouse. I think that's a horrible idea. I think you have like the polygrapher who, you know, who messes things up. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think it, mm-hmm. it can go wrong. Mm-hmm. It can go bad, mm-hmm. but I think done right, it is amazing.
Yeah. We want it to be a safe situation for everybody.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. How did you feel after stopping? I don't mean the shame and guilt, but more like, were you clear-headed? Did you view your wife differently? Did you view your life differently? My husband keeps saying how different he feels now in a good way, but can't quite put words to it. So yeah, how did you yeah. feel after stopping?
You know, one of the messages that resonated with me that I think was part of my torment when I was in it was I've wanted to finish well. You know, and what I mean by that is, you know, you go to your deathbed, you know, going, man, I did some really good things. And so, as soon as I started to work in groups, like first 2 weeks, 3 weeks or whatever, I was like, oh my gosh, this is what it's going to feel like to finish well. And so, you know, I used to like travel for business and be like, I hope the plane doesn't crash because you're going to find all this stuff. And like, I hope I don't get in a car accident on the way to work because you're going to, you know what I mean? Like, and it's just there's something to just being who you are, and everybody knows. And actually a real positive thing, like, you know, sometimes addicts don't get this right after discovery, but the reason the wife is asking you to go through these things and stuff is because she's really on your side. She really does love you. And if you would just take a moment and step back and go, wow, this person, in light of everything I've done, is still rooting for me. And because of our shame, because of our, you know, our wounds, we don't recognize that. But that's huge, because now this person who knows everything about you is still in your corner. And, you know, we don't experience that in a lot of cases, or we don't believe we experience that. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that was like the first thing that, like, now I finally had a path to finish well. And I kind of figured it out, because I couldn't figure it out. You know, it was like, I was like, what the hell's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. You know, like, and
did you mention too your physical shifts? Because that was pretty dramatic. Your blood pressure dropped.
Oh, yeah. So I had really high blood pressure for a number of years, and it was so bad that there were times it was like 180 over 100. I mean, it was bad, bad. And like, we'd go to Restore so I could just sit in the hyperbaric, and I'd have to sit there and wait for the blood pressure to come down. And all, I mean, it was just crazy things, you know what I mean? And so essentially right after that, it started coming down, and I'm not on blood pressure medicine anymore or anything like that.
Well, that was actually one of the red flags for me. Mm-hmm. Was so unlike you that you came home one day, and I don't even think that you told me. I think I saw that you were on blood pressure medication, and I was like, when did that happen? Right? Like, you didn't talk to me about that. And so that was kind of like
that was before discovery.
Yeah. Before discovery. Yeah, yeah. And that's like what I'm saying is, like, it was a little, is so unlike you, out of character, right, to, like, I knew that it was a problem for you. Yeah. I think I might have even known
that your doctor
recommended it, but it's almost like you, like, hid the decision and just did it without, you know what I mean? And yeah. So, but yeah, after discovery, it dropped and you got off medication.
Yeah. There was a lot that, you know, because of the stress of discovery and disclosure and recovery and all that stuff, there's, you know, I've gained a little bit more weight than I want to, and, you know, and stuff like that, but I'm slowly kind of working through that. But yeah, those, I think, you know, if you think about, you know, the word that always comes up to me is alignment. And so, you know, alignment is you're living in integrity of what your values are and your beliefs, and you're acting out of those. And so I think your body feels it when you're not.
Your
and
eyes
so,
that started turning yellow.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They cleared up. The yep. Whites of your eyes cleared up right after. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like it right away, it's like,
right,
things started yep. getting better yep. in terms of a health sense.
Yeah. And I would agree. Let me address that. So, you know, she says he feels really good, but he can't quite, you know, put words to it or whatever. You just feel lighter. You just, it's, and I think sometimes it's hard to, and I always never tried to articulate this to you, because you're like, because most people will view sex as like a pleasurable thing. So it's like, well, of course you were, you know what I mean? But like the anguish I would feel on it, you know, it's like one of those things, like, you never really know that your eyes are bad until you get glasses or something like that. Like, you don't really recognize how deep in anguish you are, as much as you don't like it and stuff like that, until you stop. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, like the depth of my pain was off the chart.
Yeah. I had a client whose husband basically said one time that I used to think that, how did he word it? I'm going to get this wrong, but I'll give the general gist. It was basically like, I used to think that I liked this. And now that I'm in recovery, I realize how much better I feel. My brain feels better. I'm like, you know, and the things you hear in these situations is, I'm more present, I'm more engaged, I have more sensations or feelings or, you know, whatever in life in general, more emotions mm-hmm. and stuff like that in a positive way. You're basically experiencing life again. And so they'll say, you know, it's like, in some weird way, because the addiction told me so, I thought I liked this thing or that it was doing something for me. And then I found out that this is actually so much better. And I didn't know that while I was in my addiction.
Right, right. Right. And you know, that what was the other part of that question? How did I view you?
Yeah. After stopping, did you view your wife differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think yes. I mean, I've always really thought highly of you. I've always thought you were the prettiest woman around, you know, and you would, you know, you would challenge me and your triggers. You'd be like, how could you even say that I'm the prettiest woman? You know what I mean? Like, and I've always thought, you know, which was part of the reason behind my anguish, because it was like, oh, I have this beautiful wife and, you know, what's wrong with me, you know, and stuff like that. And so I knew you were strong. I knew all of those things. I think it was like your ability, and I've said this before, your ability to hold a vision, your ability to have the strength you did to kind of go through this on a regular basis, as hard as this was really, really amazing.
I'm just going to reword this because it might be what the person that posted it is kind of looking for. Do you think when men stop masturbating or looking at pornography that they reconnect physically and emotionally with their wife in a different way?
Oh, I would say so. Yeah, I think so. You know, it's like the phrase, the pornified view of sex, you know, it's very transactional. It's very, you know, it's not. You know, you. I think when you're with somebody you love and you're deeply connected and you don't have things in your past, it has to almost be timeless and boundless. You know what I mean? When you're engaging in intimacy and when you're doing whatever you are with your wife, it shouldn't, you know, it should just flow, you know? And so I think, you know, we had to work through on the physical intimacy side, we had to work through some real big hurdles that had been created. But even in that, there were these beautiful moments that, you know, when it wasn't, you know, when we were still working through it. And so I think it's a much deeper connection. I think I always like hanging out with you, but, you know, I think that there was, you know, a lot of it was I was running, you know what I mean? I was running from my shame. I was running from, you know, it's. You know, I didn't really want, you know, you kind of think, I didn't think that at the time, but I didn't want people to see me 100%. So what do you do when you don't want people to see you? You metaphorically hide, mm-hmm. right? And so that's exactly what was happening. And so now I've, you know, you've wanted to be let in. I've let you in. And we, you know, we approach each other from this standpoint of fully knowing each other. And that's a good place to be. Mm-hmm.
Do you view your life differently? I think that's an important question because I think you would visualize like your future a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I really did struggle with that. Like, you know, what was my mission? Was I, you know, what exactly was I here to do? And so this has taken on much more of a, you know, with the ability to help other people, with the ability to talk into addiction, with the ability to be open and honest about it. And you know, it's like each and every day is a blessing now, you know, to be able to wake up and go, man, I, you know, this is, I get to live another day and maybe I'll get to talk to somebody. And I had a chance to talk to a lot of people last week about it that I would have never thought about talking to, you know, 3 years ago, you know.
Do you think men in recovery generally view their life differently?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes you'll be like, well, I don't want to talk about it. Well, that might not mean you're in recovery. If you're just like, I never want to talk about it ever again. I get it. Like it's, you know, at some point you have to kind of start moving along with your life. And, you know, like we've talked about that, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't talk about anything tonight. Maybe we should watch a movie or whatever, you know what I mean? And stuff like that. But yeah, I think, you know, I think there's a line in Concord that says when you can't tell your story, then there's a wound still.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you can't fully tell your story. So I, you know, I've gotten to the point where I'm, you know, I can tell my story. I can talk about it.
I think on both sides, there's a lot of fear there, right? Like for a long time, even though we were doing it, it felt very uncomfortable. If, you know, it comes up in conversation or whatever to go, yeah, you know, this is what we do. And this is what we talk about. And this is our podcast. Oh, well, how did you jump into that? Oh, because it's my story and my,
husband, you know? Right.
And so the first, I don't know, 50 times that I would say to somebody, my husband was a sex addict, like how uncomfortable was that? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I think it's really, and we've said this so many times that like your version of that doesn't have to be our version where, you know, I'm talking about it on TikTok and I'm talking about it on a podcast and on social media and stuff like that. But I think I really do want to encourage both partners to kind of do a gut check with that. Like if you're not comfortable talking to friends or talking to people in your life that you trust that are safe people, when things come up, I think there is healing to be done there. And here's the benefit to that. There's someone in your life
That's right.
that needs to hear this because they either know someone or they have already gone through this or they are currently going through it. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not the exact same thing, like I've had a friend say to me a couple times, you and Patrick just talk about it. And I love that. And it's like inspirational and like all this, you know, in terms of like encouraging to her to know that we are just open books when it comes to the stuff that we've gone through. And so it doesn't have to be your best friend's husband is looking at porn. It can be a friend of yours that you connect with at church who hears your story and develops a different type of relationship with you because she goes, man, if you can talk about that, like we can talk about other hard stuff, right? And that's a deeper yeah. level of friendship. And so, you know, I worry sometimes, I think when women feel very scared of sharing their story. I think sometimes in the church, there's this idea that like, well, I can't talk about it to anybody because it's shaming my husband or, right. you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, okay, well, if you're still stuck in that place, then there's probably healing to be done on both parts so that you both feel secure enough in recovery that the story comes from that perspective because our story isn't me shaming you. Our story right. is a story of you did this really bad thing. Mm-hmm. It hurt me really badly. And this is how we've moved through it, which is right. like a success story, which mm-hmm. is like huge, right? And people don't talk about that. And I think they're afraid of the shame piece. And the reality is it's a recovery right. Piece. And so I just encourage anyone to kind of listening to kind of think, how comfortable am I right now? And if, you know, and I'm not saying it's gonna be comfortable the first time, but if you're so scared, work with a therapist, get a coach, think about who is your closest, safest friend or family member and start talking to someone. I know I had a client one time that really didn't have any friends that knew, and I was really encouraging her to talk to someone. And we didn't have a session for a little while. And then she came back and she's like, oh, I told that friend. And I was like, you know, how did it go? She's like, oh, she was so supportive. You know, and I think a lot of times, especially with stuff like this, we create all of these barriers and all these stories in our mind. And it's like people love you and care about you. And people really appreciate it when you're willing to be vulnerable. Yeah. And when you are willing to take the first step in vulnerability in a relationship, it often opens up a door to have this vulnerable, deep relationship with that person because then they know that they can talk to you as well. Right. And so it ends up being really, really cool to use this in a positive way. I think so. And then, you know, if you start to tell a little bit and someone kind of responds in a way that's not safe, that's information for you. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to continue, you know, being vulnerable and open with that person. Absolutely not. So use discretion, you know, and wisdom in those situations. Yeah. But that I would encourage.
I went to West Point. I graduated in 1993. And I'm amazed at the level of support that comes from graduates. You know, my classmates who, you know, and these are all very accomplished folks who have done a lot of, you know, great things. But, you know, what you see in these moments is, yeah, but there's a lot of pain in a lot of their stories. There's a lot of divorce. There's a lot of, you know, things. And so I met up with a guy this past week who I hadn't seen in a long time. And I had gone through a training and he was asking me, what kind of learnings did you get? You know what I mean? Like, here's a guy that like, he was a wrestler and you know, was a field artillery officer and stuff like that. You know, you kind of wouldn't think that question would come out of a guy like that. Mm-hmm. But I was just, I just came out and I said, yeah, I'm trying to heal and I'm trying to get better because I was a sex addict for a number of years. And mm-hmm. he's like, yeah, interesting. You know, so it's really the response from my classmates has been very surprising in a positive way.
I think anytime someone's willing to own their story, mm-hmm. use it for good and is able to say like, this is what I've done. Or even if you're not in that place yet, but saying what I am doing mm-hmm. To fix this, to resolve it, to become a better person, to take responsibility, to show up better in life, to mm-hmm. be, you know, to heal and that sort of thing. I think people respect that, you know, yeah. And if they don't, that says so much more about them.
Right, right, exactly.
Okay, well, Patrick, we did not get through all of the questions.
Ooh.
So good news, you're going to have a part two next week.
Part two, nice.
All right, thanks for joining us, everyone. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you get notified when these come out, and we will see you next week.
Woohoo! If you're listening to this, it means you've made it through an entire episode. Part of recovery is spending time engaging in healing and self-growth activities. We are thankful that you chose our podcast to be one of those activities today. Make sure you reward yourself for that accomplishment. If you've enjoyed this episode or this podcast, we would love to hear from you. Please take just a few moments to leave a rating and review, letting us know your experience with RecoverU. We not only love hearing how these episodes are helpful, but ratings and reviews help others just like you who are searching for recovery information and support find the podcast too. We can't wait to hear from you. See you next week.